This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're looking at the history and legacy of the largest World War II internment camp for enemy aliens, Crystal City, Texas. Texas Monthly contributing editor Jan Jarboe Russell has written a book about the Crystal City camp, and more importantly, she has uncovered new information about the reasoning for these camps and why they were established. The book is titled The Train to Crystal City, FDR's Secret Prisoner Exchange Program and America's Only Family Internment Camp During World War II. Russell explains that much of the information about these camps has been kept secret and unknown to the American public.
I think it was unknown for several reasons. First of all, because it was the isolated location of the camp, 120 miles from San Antonio, in a place far from vital war efforts. Additionally, when the internees left the camp, under whatever circumstances, they signed secrecy oaths that they would not discuss the camp. And that may sound strange, but given the amount of trouble they had experienced during World War II, the fear of the government coming back at them was always present and was present in their children.
The big question was always, why? Why these camps? They were not, it's not, you know, you look at it from the outside, this is not a very smart thing to do during World War II. We were using all of these resources, in which there was great scarcity at the time, to house all of these people in these locations who, you didn't have to investigate very far to realize they were pretty harmless. But why was this going on? And finally, we're finding out, and your book tells that story.
Yes, you know, this whole thing began with the question, why for me? And I, if I can take a little time, you know, I first learned about this very anecdotally more than 40 years ago when I was a young reporter at the Daily Texan at the University of Texas, and I met a professor, Alan Taniguchi, and he was the first person to tell me about the Crystal City internment camp. I was so naive. I was from East Texas, and you know, the gates of the world were opening to me as a young journalist. And when I first heard Alan's description of the camp in Crystal City, that was my question. Why? Why did they put all those people there, and where is Crystal City? And the truth of the matter is that over the years, like a lot of reporters, I kind of followed it. John McCormick has done some story for the Express News about it. Others have done it. But that question you ask, why, was at the heart of it for me. And so when I learned that Alan Taniguchi, when I circled back in 2010 to try to get some information from Alan Taniguchi about the camp, a place to start, I learned he had died. And I'll tell you what, my heart fell to my feet because I thought, you know what? Nobody's ever going to be able to tell this story. But I got a list of his friends, both German-American kids and Japanese-American kids, and that day I started calling them. So the first round of reporting was interviews with living kids, but they had no idea why they were in camp. So the second round of reporting was the hard work of going through the files at the National Archives, getting their fathers' FBI files, and then if their fathers were enemy aliens, as all fathers in Crystal City were, they had what the FBI called a special file. Slowly, the dark secrets of the camp revealed themselves, and it does make sense. Think about the experience of the American prisoners of war in Japan and in Germany during the war. Roosevelt was sitting there with reports all the time about the terrible treatment of our POWs. But even before we joined the war, he knew, like all presidents know, that once you're in a war, you better have a pool of people that you can trade so that you can get your guys out. That pool, the center of that pool was Crystal City, Texas. That the big secret of the camp was that not the INS, which was the running the camp, but a special division called the War Problems Divisions within the Department of States was charged by Roosevelt with creating a pool of people that they could exchange for Americans, POWs, businessmen, journalists, religious leaders, missionaries in both Germany and Japan. And this book essentially describes why the camp, how the camp operated, who was in the camp. But at its heart, it is a story of prisoner exchange.
German Americans, they were the largest ethnic group that we had in the United States. And to suddenly say this group is going to be targeted and put in internment camps, you can't put all of them in internment camps. How did they go about figuring out who needed to be locked up?
You know, it was really interesting as I went through the records. Roosevelt was more afraid of Germany than Japan. He thought it would be Germany. And before, in the run-up to the war, he thought it was going to be Germany that got us into war. And so, of course, Pearl Harbor was a terrible surprise. But he told Francis Biddle and before Pearl Harbor that he was wanted to target Germans and Italians because he was afraid of them. But he had the problem you described. There were so many Germans, so he could not arrest all of them. So the FBI had a three-tier list, an A, B, and C category of what kind of Germans and what kind of Italians that they would arrest. And number one on the list is if you were a member of the American Bund, which is the American Nazi Party, you were arrested. Fritz Kuhn, who was the head of the party, was in Crystal City and was exchanged. And that was a very significant exchange because Fritz Kuhn was a high-value exchangee for Germany. They wanted him back. Roosevelt didn't want to give him up because he thought that Fritz Kuhn had too much information about our American military resources. So essentially, that was Category 1. Category B was if you were arrested according to your occupation. If you were an engineer, as my main German-American character's father was, Matthias Eiserl, he was an engineer in Cleveland, Ohio. If you were an engineer and you'd built a dam or you'd built roads like Matthias had, then the FBI thought, well, if you can build a dam, you can blow one up. And they thought that engineers had access to vital, roads and dams. If you were a photographer, you were automatically targeted. If you were a priest and a leader of your community, if you were the head of an agricultural co-op, you were targeted. So essentially, from the years 1942 to the camp closed in 1948, 3 long years after the war was over, you had the leaders of the Japanese community in this country and the German community in this country.
So the point being that when you have the largest ethnic minority in the country, the Germans leading up to World War II, and they could be targeted, you look at it back to today and you say, these laws are still on the books. They could still do this anytime they wanted to any group that they wanted. Is the lesson behind the internment camps in Crystal City, I mean, the same law that the executive order that allowed this to happen is the one that's being used in Guantanamo Bay. So this is still very relevant to today.
Yeah, I think there are several lessons. First of all, as American citizens, I think we are naive about prisoner exchange. Every war since the first war, American Revolutionary War, leading up to today, has involved prisoner exchanges. And so when the government tells us we don't negotiate with terrorists, that's political speak. Because, of course, we're negotiating to try to get our people back from the Middle East. So waking up to the fact that prisoner exchange is an unfortunate and untallied cost of war, that's lesson one for me. Number two, the great tragedy of Crystal City, in my view, is not really that we interned these people or that we even exchanged some of them. The tragedy is that American-born children, people that were born in America, were traded for ostensibly more important Americans coming back from Japan and Germany. I believe those children deserve an apology, and I believe that it's a great stain. And so I would hope that if we're trading people today, that we would not trade Americans for Americans.
So the United States has issued an apology and did pay some restitutions for
For
the Japanese, but never for the Germans or the Italians or
that's any other. Right. And I think it's a real sore spot, especially with the Germans. The Italians, there were only 12 Italian families in Crystal City, and the internment of Italians was stopped fairly in 1 year into the war. It didn't last as long as the internment of the German and Japanese. But the German-American children have petitioned. They've asked Congress to look at their situation. There was a wonderful long lawsuit and that went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was denied.
And was that the habeas corpus lawsuit?
Yes, it was the habeas corpus lawsuit. And so the argument is that, and the Japanese have this argument, that they were interned because of their race. Every single 120,000 of them, two-thirds of them American, the entire West Coast, taken into camps. So that's a very big burden. The Germans were interned because of their ethnicity, but they were interned in smaller numbers. And for some reason, that hasn't rated an apology. Nobody in the German-American internee coalition that I know is asking for money or reparations. But these people are dying off by the week. And I believe, and I hope that my book serves as an apology to these people who gave a lot for the war effort.
The U.S. government and J. Edgar Hoover with the FBI went around looking for individuals that they thought could be saboteurs or informants, some sort of turncoat for the Nazis and for the emperor in Japan. Did they actually find anybody who was a saboteur or some sort of individual who posed a real danger to the United States?
You know, we'll never know because there were never any charges filed against people. They never knew why they were arrested or what. But the scholar.
Let me just ask this one question though: if they had found somebody who had plans or had the means and who was going to do some dangerous act, would they have just put them in an internment camp, or wouldn't they have trotted them out in a big show trial?
That's my conclusion as well, David. I don't think they made the case against any of them. Now, I will say I've really looked into this and talked to scholars especially regarding the Germans. And Max Paul Friedan, who is a professor at the University of Florida, is probably the best on this subject. And he thinks that less than 1% of all the German prisoners of war arrested in the United States during World War II could be called Nazis, that the rest of them were just German immigrants living here legally, caught up in hysteria. And that's his estimate, and I trust that estimate.
Many of these Germans, Americans, they spoke German around the house. They took a German newspaper. They belonged to German clubs.
Right.
They were very much, you know, that was a big part of their identity, was their German heritage.
It is. And for those of us in San Antonio and in the Hill Country, we respect the heritage of the Germans. It's a big part of our culture as well. So whether or not you're German or German-American, this should bother you that just because you were German that you were taken.
So you did the real work. You went through the records and the archives and got the original documents, stuff that had never actually been seen before and reported on. What are still the mysteries?
I guess one of the mysteries for me is why the camp stayed open 3 years after the war. That just seems incomprehensible to me. But the only way I can make sense of it is that when the war was over, of course, nobody in the camp knew that the war was over because all the war news was censored. So when the word got out and that Germany had lost the war and Japan had lost the war, many of the men that were still there, German and Japanese, didn't believe it. They didn't believe that there was a way that Japan or Germany could lose the war.
Right. So, you know, the war ended in stages.
In stages.
First, we had the surrender of Germany.
Right.
And then we had to switch our focus all over to the Pacific theater.
Right.
But so the Germans were going, our war is over. Why are we still in here? And then it continues even after we have to wait until we drop the bombs on Japan
right.
to get their surrender, and then even then, they're still in the camp.
But the internees didn't know any of that. But what they did, when word began to leak out, many of them started filing lawsuits to keep the – see, the government's solution to how to close the camp was they were going to deport everybody. They were going to deport everybody in camp, no matter who you were, back to Germany and to Japan. Well, when that happened, people like Eberhard Fuhrer and others, the Fukuda family from San Francisco, those fathers started pushing back, filing lawsuits to keep from being deported. And so these people ultimately tied up the legal system enough that they ran the clock out and they were finally freed. But I think this is something else to consider. You ask about a lesson, and now it's just coming to me. You know, one of the reasons that we need to that I think that Obama is having a hard time closing Guantanamo Bay isn't political. It's what do you do with these people once you get them? How do you, what now that we have them, and let's say we want to close them, what do we do with them?
Right. So in Guantanamo, we have rounded up people who were completely innocent.
Yeah.
Cab drivers who were just plucked off the street because they got their money from the government to do that. You throw them in Guantanamo, and then these people, the fear is, oh, well, now they've become radicalized.
Right.
So and, when now we had these people who were German citizens, German Americans, thrown into the camp, and they say, well, we can't just put them back out on the street in America.
Bingo. That's the that I think we've together have helped solve this mystery. Why was the camp open, and what does that have to say? So, in other words, even though this happened long ago, the template for one of the conclusions that I have drawn for my personal self is that by whatever name you call it, detention camp, internment camp, prison camp. Whenever you create these facilities, what you are doing is implying exchange. The reason we have them is for exchange, or at least for that eventuality. So I hope to not be so naive as an American citizen when they start throwing words around like internment camp that a red flag ought to come up. What is the purpose of the internment camp? How are you going to close it? What are the rights of the people in the camp?
One of your characters, Ingrid.
Yes.
And she goes through life not knowing why this happened to her and her family. Eventually, you supply the answer. What do you tell her?
Well, you know, the research of this was so thrilling because it was like finding truth. It was almost like I kept holding the image of a crystal. A crystal has many perspectives. I kept finding new perspectives.
And the crystal splits the light.
The crystal splits the light. And so for me, the image of Crystal City was a metaphor for my book, that I had to have many perspectives. So what happened is I got deep into the details of the January 1945 exchange from Crystal City into Germany. And I began to wonder, to try to find out who, when Ingrid and her family and all the rest of them, when they were going to be going from Switzerland into Germany on a train after having made a long sea voyage from New York to Marseille in France, I began to wonder who's coming out. Who are the people that Ingrid and her parents were going to free? And so I did get a list of the exchangees, and some of them were some prisoners of war, and I mentioned them. But in a great surprise, I learned that we didn't have enough Americans inside Germany at this late date in the war to trade. And so a small number of Jews from Bergen-Belsen concentration camp were also on the train coming out. And I went to the National Holocaust Museum in Washington, and I found a list of all the Jews that were on the exchange list from Bergen-Belsen on January 2nd, 1945. When I found this list, I started trying to find people on the list that were still alive. And to, of course, my shock and horror, I could only find two people that were still alive. Jacob Wolf lived in Brooklyn, and Irene Butter, who lived in Ann Arbor. I went to see both of these people and spent most of my time with Irene Hossenberg Butter and got her story, which is a terrible story. But I was very surprised to see that Irene and Ingrid were the same age, exactly the same age, and they looked a lot alike. And so I showed Irene Ingrid's picture, and I went to Honolulu where Ingrid was living, and I was scared to tell her about this. I didn't know how she would react. So I took the list of Jews saved that day, and I pointed to Irene's. And Ingrid was running her fingers through the list of 300 names, and only 100 of those 300 that were on the list made it out. And she kept going over Irene's name with her index finger, and she said, "Jan," she said, "this now makes all the sense in the world to me." She said, "Everything my family went through, everything we lost, it all was worth it to me because Irene and her family got out." And there was a real moment. She said, "You know, the craziest thing about the war to me was war is war. You expect people to sacrifice. But I never understood what we were sacrificing for." But now she knew that she was sacrificing so that Irene and she had another human being that she could connect to. These two women wanted to meet, but time ran out for Ingrid. 2 months after that day, she died in Honolulu and never got to meet Irene.
But still with a sense of peace.
With a sense of meaning, and I hope peace.
Jan Jarboe-Russell is the author of The Train to Crystal City, FDR's Secret Prisoner Exchange Program, and America's Only Family Internment Camp During World War II. She is a contributing editor for Texas Monthly, and she is the author of Lady Bird, a biography of Mrs. Johnson. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.